3, 2, 1, liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast, episode 69, Troika. On July 20th, 1969, the United States successfully landed men on the moon with Apollo 11. This success, however, did not mean that the Soviet Union subsequently ceded outer space to American dominance. Instead, the Soviet Union sought to compete in another aspect of space. As I previewed in episode 63, when I talked about the Soviet Union's response to Apollo 8, there were basically four ideas floating around. First, the Soviet Union could emphasize unmanned missions, such as an automated lunar sample return mission or an automated circumlunar flight. Second, the Soviet Union could uprate the N1L3 manned lunar landing program, leading eventually to long-duration stays on the moon. Third, the Soviet Union could invest in a manned mission to Mars. This mission would, of course, take place over a longer horizon, and would take perhaps a decade to complete. The fourth idea was to focus on the construction of an Earth orbital space station as an outgrowth of the Soviet Union's existing Earth orbital program with the Soyuz 7K-OK. In the months immediately after Apollo 11, the Soviet Union's ultimate goal for responding to the American moon landing was uncertain. The Soviet Union's initial plans appear to have been to highlight the benefits of unmanned probes as a contrast to the high cost and high risk of manned spaceflight programs like Apollo. In part, the focus on unmanned spacecraft was simply due to the availability of equipment. As I've mentioned before, since at least 1967, the Soviet Union had been emphasizing the production and launch of its Soyuz 7K-L1 circumlunar spacecraft. And starting around 1968, the Soviet Union had begun working on an automated lunar rover and lunar sample retrieval mission, both to support the N1L3 manned lunar landing program and as a backup plan in case the Americans landed on the moon first. Well, by 1969, the L1 spacecraft and the automated lunar sample retrieval probes were all ready. Some of this I have already covered, like the launch of Zond 5 and Zond 6 in late 1968, as well as the Luna 15 mission that occurred at the same time as Apollo 11. As a result, after Apollo 11, the L1 spacecraft and the lunar sample retrieval probes were the first equipment on hand for the Soviet Union to demonstrate that it remained a relevant power in outer space. On August 8, 1969, just a little over 2 weeks after Apollo 11 ended, the Soviet Union launched Zond 7. Zond 7 was another automated L1 circumlunar spacecraft that carried turtles and other live specimen. Vasily Mishin had been planning the Zond 7 mission since March 1969, 4 months before Apollo 11. Mishin had also argued in favor of launching a crewed version of the L1 spacecraft. But after Apollo 8, the Soviet Union disfavored the idea of a manned circumlunar flight, as such a mission would only serve to emphasize that the Soviet Union was behind the United States. At Mishin's continued insistence, however, The Communist Party allowed the launch of another automated L-1 spacecraft, since the equipment was already on hand. And this was the spacecraft that became Zond 7. The Soviet Union downplayed the significance of Zond 7 after its launch. The Soviets feared another failure, and after Apollo 11, even a successful automated circumlunar flight around the moon would not demonstrate Soviet superiority in space. Zond 7 turned out to be a very successful mission, encountering only minor problems on its way to the moon. Zond 7 flew within 1,200 kilometers of the moon and returned color photos. Then, on August 14, 1969, 6 days after launch, Zond 7 returned home and landed in Kazakhstan. Zond 7 was so successful that Vasily Mishyn once again argued in favor of launching a crewed circumlunar flight. He pointed out that the Soviet Union had already produced the L-1 spacecraft that was necessary for the mission. But the Communist Party's resistance to launching a crewed circumlunar flight after Apollo 8 only became more staunch after Apollo 11. They did not want a mission that would highlight American dominance in space. The Soviet government would allow Mishyn to launch the remaining L-1 spacecraft as automated flights only. The dream of a crewed circumlunar flight was dead. Besides the L-1 spacecraft, the Soviet Union also had on hand the automated lunar sample retrieval probes in 1969, also known as the Year 85. Luna 15, launched in competition with Apollo 11, was one of these probes. Although Luna 15 had crashed into the lunar surface on July 21, 1969, these new automated probes now fit into the new Soviet state dogma to emphasize lunar exploration using unmanned spacecraft. So, in the 6 months after Apollo 11, the Soviet Union would continue to launch these Year 85 automated lunar sample retrieval probes. Unfortunately for the Soviet Union, all of the lunar sample retrieval missions failed through early 1970. The first attempted sample retrieval mission after Luna 15 occurred on September 23, 1969. A UR-500 rocket lifted a probe into orbit, but there the Block D translunar injection stage failed to fire to propel the probe toward the moon. The Soviet Union ended up calling this probe Cosmos 300 to hide the fact that it was supposed to be a Luna probe. The second attempt occurred a month later on October 22nd. A UR-500 rocket placed the probe into Earth orbit once again, but the Block D translunar injection stage failed to fire. And yet again, to hide the fact that this was supposed to be a Luna probe, the Soviets called it Cosmos 305 and pretended like it was a mere satellite. The third attempt occurred on February 6, 1970. This time, the probe never even got into space, as the first stage of the UR-500 rocket exploded. Clearly, something was wrong with the UR-500 rocket. By now, this conclusion was obvious even to the West. Of the 19 launches between 1967 and 1970, 10 of them, more than half, failed to even reach orbit. Another 3 launches failed to send the payload onto the moon. only 6 missions had been successful. So by 1970, even Vladimir Chelemy, who developed the UR-500, agreed that the rocket needed to go back through a qualification program. Although the Soviet Union was emphasizing the virtues of unmanned missions for lunar exploration, when it came to operations in Earth orbit, the Soviet Union did not shy away from manned spaceflight. This was an area in which the Soviet Union could still achieve some meaningful firsts before the United States. Initially, the Soviet Union's Earth orbital Soyuz 7K-OK was meant to support its eventual N1L3 moon landing mission by providing experience for performing rendezvous and other maneuvers in space, similar to what Gemini had done for Apollo. Thus, in January 1969, the Soviet Union had launched Soyuz 4 and Soyuz 5, which rendezvoused and docked in Earth orbit. For the next Earth orbital mission, Vasily Mishin had planned to launch another pair of Soyuz 7K-OK to rendezvous using the radar system that would be used on the L3 spacecraft for the lunar landing mission. But in early 1969, that rendezvous system was still not ready, and it was becoming increasingly clear that NASA would soon land men on the moon. So a Soviet lunar landing was no longer a priority. As a result, Mishin looked for some other mission that would continue to demonstrate Soviet relevance in space for propaganda purposes. In February 1969, Mishin landed upon the idea of a triple flight, or a troika. He would launch 3 Soyuz 7K-OK. 2 of them would dock, while the 3rd would fly around to take pictures of the scene for propaganda purposes. With as many as 7 cosmonauts in space at one time during this triple flight, there would also be many opportunities for scientific experiments. One particular experiment was to learn how to weld in space. There was also a thought that one of the spacecraft should remain in orbit to reclaim the absolute endurance record for being in space. This docking and triple flight mission, as well as the welding experiment in particular, would also serve to support one of the potential goals that the Soviet Union had identified after Apollo 8, the creation of an Earth orbital space station. After Apollo 11 in July 1969, the Soviet Union looked to Vasily Mishin's triple flight proposal urgently as a way for the Soviet Union to provide a quick response to American success. But then the Soviet government got cold feet. They feared that if there was another accident, say something like Soyuz 1, that accident would only be contrasted with the unqualified success of Apollo 11. As a result, although the triple flight had originally been planned for August 1969, it was not until September 1969 that the Soviet government finally gave Mishin permission to launch the Troika. These would become known as Soyuz 6, 7, and 8. The first launch, Soyuz 6, occurred on October 11, 1969. Aboard Soyuz 6 were 2 cosmonauts, Georgi Shonin and Valery Kubasov. Both were new to space. Soyuz 6 was the spacecraft that would not perform any docking. The spacecraft had not been equipped with a docking apparatus. It would simply observe the docking of the other 2 Soyuz to be launched later. Soyuz 6 did, however, carry the key experiment to learn welding in space. That experiment was known as the Vulcan apparatus. The next day, on October 12th, the Soviets launched Soyuz 7 with three cosmonauts. These were Colonel Anatoly Flipchenko, the commander of Soyuz 7, Vladislav Volkov, and Viktor Gorbatko, both research engineers. Soyuz 7 had been equipped with the passive docking system. On the third day, October 13th, the Soviets launched Soyuz 8, which carried the active docking system. Aboard Soyuz 8 were two cosmonauts, Vladimir Shatilov and Alexei Yeliseyev. Both of them were veterans, having been involved in the previous rendezvous and docking mission with Soyuz 4 and Soyuz 5 10 months earlier in January 1969. Indeed, Shatilov was the only cosmonaut with any docking experience and had been named the overall commander of the Soyuz 6, 7, and 8 mission. For the first time in history, there were now three manned spacecraft in orbit at the same time, as well as a record number of humans in space, a total of seven cosmonauts. Initially, each spacecraft pursued its own experiments. Soyuz 6 started with biomedical research. Soyuz 7 focused on taking pictures of the Earth and stellar objects. Soyuz 7 examined the polarization of sunlight as reflected in the atmosphere. Eventually, all three spacecraft rendezvoused on October 14th, 1969. Although the rendezvous does not appear to have been perfect, as subsequent events will show. All three spacecraft managed a roughly common orbit and came as close as about 500 meters to each other. At this distance, an automated system was supposed to take over and bring Soyuz 8 to within about 100 meters of Soyuz 7. From there, Shatilov was to manually pilot Soyuz 8 into a docking with Soyuz 7. But during the first day of rendezvous, Shatilov could not close the 500-meter separation between Soyuz 8 and Soyuz 7, despite multiple attempts. The reason for the failure to approach any closer is still mired in mystery due to continued secrecy surrounding the triple flight. Indeed, to this day, the Russians have not published any photos of this mission. But it would appear that there was probably something faulty with the automated rendezvous system, and Shatilov was unable to close any further because Soyuz 8 and Soyuz 7 were in just slightly different orbits, a fact that he seems to have been unable to correct. After failing to dock during the first day after rendezvous, the Soviets tried again on the second day. This time, Soyuz 8 was unable to approach any closer than 1,700 meters of Soyuz 7. In the end, the Soviets called off the effort to dock. Shatilov had used too much fuel on Soyuz 8 to make any further attempts. Instead, Soyuz 6, 7, and 8 would simply maintain a coordinated flight path for 3 days. During the coordinated flight, the crew aboard Soyuz 6, Shonin and Kubasov, performed that critical welding experiment that could be used in the future for the construction of an Earth orbital space station. To perform the experiment, Shonin and Kubasov stayed in the descent compartment of the Soyuz 6 and closed the hatch to the living compartment. They then depressurized the living compartment to perform the welding experiment in the vacuum of space. The entire welding experiment was automated. The cosmonauts only turned the experiment on. The Vulcan apparatus would then apply three welding methods to a sheet of metal. As it turns out, the Vulcan welding experiment was nearly a fatal disaster, though the world would not know this until after the collapse of the Soviet Union over 20 years later. During one of the welds, the Vulcan apparatus melted a part of the internal wall in the living compartment. Fortunately, the external wall of the spacecraft had not been punctured. The cosmonauts, though, only realized this damage when they repressurized the living compartment to open the hatch between the living compartment and the descent compartment to retrieve the samples. With the welding experiment over, Soyuz 6 returned home on October 16, 1969, after almost 5 days in space. Soyuz 7 remained in orbit until the next day, when it too re-entered the atmosphere and returned home. Soyuz 8 followed suit on October 18th, thus bringing an end to the flight of the Troika. The Soviet Union publicly claimed that the flight of Soyuz 6, 7, and 8 was a complete success. They claimed that docking was not part of the mission objective. But even at that time, it was obvious to Western observers that docking was supposed to be part of the mission. And if the triple flight was supposed to reclaim some sort of status for the Soviet Union after Apollo 11, it utterly failed to do so. Instead, the meandering nature of the triple flight that did not seem to have any particular goal, especially with the Soviets denying that docking was one of those goals, seemed to be reflective of the lost and meandering nature of the Soviet space program in general in the aftermath of Apollo 11. Despite the failure of the main mission objective, the Troika did lend credibility to the Soviet Union's claims that it has not, and never was, interested in the moon. The flight of three manned spacecraft in Earth orbit did seem to support the Soviet falsehood that they were interested only in Earth orbital operations, particularly the creation of a space station. And in October 1969, shortly after the end of the triple flight, Leonid Brezhnev gave a speech identifying a space station as the Soviet Union's next objective in space. Thus, in reality, the Soviet Union became interested in a space station only in the aftermath of Apollo 11 as a way to respond to the moon landing. And it made sense. Out of all the ideas that had been thrown out as a response to Apollo 11, such as an unmanned exploration of the moon, an expansion of the N1L3 program for extended human missions to the moon, and a manned mission to Mars, a space station was the option that offered the highest propaganda value that could be completed in a relatively short time frame. The Soviet Union's pursuit of a space station, however, will lead to one of the greatest tragedies of manned spaceflight history. Before we get to that, however, I need to take us back to the United States, where in November 1969, NASA launches the second moon landing mission, Apollo 12.